Sometimes being a person with PMS and or menopause is hard. Every few weeks, there's the struggles of bloating, cravings, and an overall feeling of discomfort in our skin. But now with Happy Mammoth's Hormone Harmony, it can be easier to manage symptoms. Hormone Harmony contains science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. The beauty of adaptogens is that they help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life. Hormone Harmony can help with so many hormone-related issues. Emily has been using it, and what she has enjoyed is how it supports hormonal balance and regulation, promotes healthy weight loss, can help curb cravings, and relieve mood swings. Feeling like myself again is mentioned over and over in Happy Mammoth's reviews, and there are over 17,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code RAIN at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code RAIN for 15% off today.
It's never been easy for me to serve delicious, wholesome, homemade meals that are budget-friendly and kid-approved. At least, not until now. Gobble, my favorite meal prep kit, makes it so easy. All Gobble meal kits are designed by professional chefs and are pre-prepped. That means less work for you and less waste in your kitchen. Gobble meals include gourmet, chef-made ingredients that make cooking a breeze, from signature sauces and unique spice blends to compound butters, marinades, and reductions. With a huge range of weekly meals, Gobble makes it easy for families of all tastes and sizes to build a menu everyone will love. Childhood favorites, trending ingredients, and bold new flavors. There's always something to discover, so dinner is never boring. One of my favorite things is I can easily switch up my menu. Some days we go for family favorites, other days I'm on my own and can order lean and clean meals to ensure I hit my nutritional goals. Personally, I find Gobble to be so refreshing for a number of reasons. I'm a single mom with a teenage daughter, and we're not only trying to save money, but also reduce food waste, and she's learning how to cook. I don't want to send her off to college without the skills to feed herself, so Gobble has been the perfect way to learn new recipes and have her cook them herself. Not to mention, we have the perfect amount of ingredients for two meals, so we aren't wasting money by throwing out leftovers or buying more ingredients than we need.
See what a difference Gobble will make for your household. Right now, they're offering our listeners a fantastic limited-time deal. Get $120 off across four boxes, plus free shipping and free cookies. Just go to gobble.com/therain. That's gobble.com/therain today. This offer is not available on their home site, so do not miss out. This is Murder in the Rain, where each week Emily Rowney, Alicia Holland, and Josh McCullough tell true crime stories of the Pacific Northwest. Murder in the Rain contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised. This is something new for us, a two-part update episode, and here's why. I went through all of our cases and set up Google Alerts, and let me tell you, those alerts have been dinging left and right. Interestingly, the abundance of updates didn't just happen because I had set up something like 200 alerts, which did bring a lot of these to my attention, but there was a lot of bizarre timing. Several of my cases have recently had sentences or other changes in their status. So instead of cramming all of them into one update, we're doing this episode to focus on those stories. As you may have heard in our last episode, we are taking our second ever hiatus. Back in 2022, we took a break so Josh could have open heart surgery or whatever. And now we're taking it for other reasons. Emily has had a couple of medical procedures by choice, nothing to be concerned about, and she's healing wonderfully. We've also just finished helping planning and attending the True Crime Fest Northwest. And now Josh and I are just a couple of weeks away from getting hitched. So this will be our last episode for just a couple of weeks. So be sure to follow us on all of the socials to stay up to date on when we will be back. On a personal note, I have a favor to ask of you, dear listener, while we're away. You know, we've been at this for 5 years. We've released over 200 episodes, and that's not counting what's on Patreon. And podcasting, though some people think it might be really glamorous and financially lucrative, it's not always that way. So my favor is, while we're on our break, could you share our show with just one other person in your life who you know enjoys true crime? We know that word of mouth is the best way to build listenership, and if everyone listening shared the show with one person, we would be in a place where we could make more donations, help even more people, and maybe not have to ask my mommy for money. So thank you.
Please help me feed my hungry dog.
She demands farmer's dog, and we just can't afford it. The first update comes from my episode, Tell Everyone on This Train I Love Them, about the stabbing attack on a MAX commuter train in May 2017 that left several people injured and two people dead. I would like to at some point revisit this episode, and by revisit, I mean rewrite it. I don't disagree with the things I wrote, but we were amid a COVID lockdown, the mental health issues that came with that, and getting tackled by police while protesting police brutality. So my anger toward white supremacy remains just as passionate. I just know I could express myself better now, or at least I hope I could. You can listen to the episode for free on our Patreon, or you can search on our YouTube. For now, I'm going to give you a brief recap before we get to the update. Jeremy Chastain's relationship with police began back in 1996 when he earned citations and reports were made about his behavior while on public transportation. In 2002, Jeremy was sent to prison for 8 years after committing an armed robbery and attempted kidnapping. During that incident, Jeremy was shot in the face by a police officer. He was injured but survived. Most of Jeremy's 8-year sentence was spent in solitary confinement due to his love of racial slurs and starting fights. In 2015, he received a citation for criminal trespassing. Through the years, he seemed to find himself involved in random incidents to varying degrees of severity. Jeremy was known for living with his mother in North Portland. He didn't date or have a job. He was, in his own words, a bit of a transient. On May 25, 2017, Jeremy was riding a MAX train when he started to yell threats and slurs at fellow passengers. At one point, he said, "I'm about to stab some motherfuckers. Call the police. I dare you." Demetria Hester was one of those passengers. She was the only Black person on the train. She caught Jeremy's eye and he focused in on her. She didn't shy away from his rage and she said, "As a paid rider, would you please lower your voice? No one wants to hear you threaten or terrorize other people because of their gender, their race, or who they were." He responded with, "Fuck you, bitch," and an unironic, "I built this country. You don't have the right to speak. You're Black. You don't have the right to be here. All you Muslims, Blacks, Jews, I will kill all of you." Riding through several uncomfortable stops, Demetria embarked at her line exchange. Once outside, she saw Jeremy had done the same thing and continued his rants. She wound up using her mace on his face, and he responded by throwing a Gatorade bottle full of sangria at Demetria, which struck her in the head. No witnesses or TriMet employees came to her aid. Police arrived 20 minutes later. Jeremy was still at the scene. Demetria pointed to Jeremy as the perp. Even though Jeremy was washing the mace out of his eyes, the officers didn't believe Demetria when she claimed he had been the assailant because they had already asked Jeremy about it, and he said he had not been involved.
Was that the police?
Yes.
Crackerjack work.
The report would say Demetria had been asked twice to point out the responsible party and that she had not pointed to Jeremy. Instead of arresting the man, they ran the ID of a bleeding Black woman. Jeremy got bored and just walked away. After he was gone, Demetria told the officers, "Catch him because he's going to harm or kill someone." Just 18 hours later, on May 26, 2017, 38-year-old Jeremy was once again on the train, this time riding from Portland State University to Clackamas Town Center. It was 4:30 p.m. The train was full of commuters. Two teenage girls had become lost and wound up on the wrong train in more than one way. Jeremy was 250 pounds, and he sat across from the 16- and 17-year-old girls. After locking eyes, he made a throat-slitting motion with his hand across his neck. He then started to verbally attack them, especially the girl who was wearing her hijab. For 8 minutes, he went off on them, telling them to burn, kill themselves, to get out of the country. The girls were desperate for help that they were not getting. The girls then got up and moved seats, hoping to get as far away from the man as they could. That was when one man on the train tried to get Jeremy to calm himself. It didn't work. Neither did the moving of the seats for the girls. Jeremy followed them and continued his vitriol. They watched on as grown men let this transpire, as no one pushed the emergency button or called for help. Finally, a change came when Sean Ford placed himself between the man and the girls. Like Demetria, Sean tried, "Hey man, it's Friday, no one wants to hear all this," earning him a "fuck off" from Jeremy. Hoping his military training would be of use, Sean pointed to the Marine insignia on his hat. Another passenger, Micah Fletcher, who unknowingly had dealt with Jeremy's hate speech at a rally just a month before, then stepped up. The men kept their cool and distance, even as Jeremy reached into his pocket for an unknown object. From the back of the train, another young man, Tally Essen, approached the situation while filming on his phone. Jeremy's attention was now focused on Tally Essen. After Sean's redirection, Micah stayed back. Jeremy then stood up to Tally Essen. In just 7 seconds, Tally Essen approached Jeremy, Micah joined them. Jeremy pushed Micah on the shoulders, causing him to fall into the train's wall. Jeremy pushed Tally Essen's shoulders. Micah grabbed Jeremy's shirt and or ponytail and threw him to the ground with a "fuck off, boy." Jeremy popped right back up. Now supporting Tally Essen and Micah was Rick Best. The three men hoped to get Jeremy off the train. Jeremy pushed into Micah. Micah pushed back. Words were exchanged. Micah pushed Jeremy into his seat. He took a moment to move something from his left hand to his right hand before standing again. Unbeknownst to the men, he had opened a folding knife. Distracted by looking at Jeremy's face, the men didn't realize that the knife was open and behind Jeremy's leg. Hoping to be able to use the force of the three men to push Jeremy out the train doors, Micah gave him a "go on, get." The entire exchange lasted 30 seconds. The initial push had not been enough to get Jeremy off the train. Pushing again, Jeremy told the men, "Hit me again, motherfucker, I dare you." With the doors now opened, Micah pushed again. Jeremy was as unmovable as a statue. Micah was punched in the neck. When he saw blood covering his shirt, he realized he had not been punched, he had been stabbed. His jugular had been sliced by the knife. He fell to the ground and crawled away. Before Tally Essen could put his phone down, his neck was struck as well, opening his carotid artery. Rick Best, the fourth to become involved, was ambushed and also stabbed in the neck. Arteries were severed and he died nearly instantly. It didn't matter to Jeremy, who continued to stab him in the neck and face with such force that one of Rick's molars was shattered. Jeremy went back to Tally Essen and stabbed him in the forehead, skull, behind his ear, and, in a defensive move, his hand. From the time Micah was stabbed to the other two men being stabbed, leaving Rick dead, was just 12 seconds. Micah survived thanks in part to gauze that emergency personnel had to place in his wound with their fingers. He said he could feel them in his neck. Tally Essen was declared dead at the hospital. Growing up in Ashland, Tally Essen Namkai Mesh had just begun his internship for a consulting company after graduating from Reed College in 2016. He was known for being a gentle, loving, exuberant spirit. He was a spiritual man who studied philosophy, economics, and nature. He was only 23 years old. Rick Best was a 53-year-old, 23-year veteran of the Army. After years in Iraq and Afghanistan, he worked for the City of Portland's Bureau of Development Services Department. He had three sons and a daughter in Happy Valley. After a standoff that lasted just minutes, Jeremy Christian was taken into custody unharmed, a fact many took issue with when people like Manny Ellis in Seattle can be killed for just walking down the street. Some of the 15 counts Jeremy was charged with were 2 counts of murder in the first degree, attempted murder in the first degree, assault in the first degree, assault in the second degree, intimidation in the second degree, unlawful use of a weapon, and menacing. These included charges regarding the assault on Demetria as well. Jeremy's defense was that he was practicing free speech, the attacks were done in self-defense, and he had had mental health issues and autism. He was found guilty on all counts and sentenced to true life plus 25 years. Now for the update. On July 17th of this year, Jeremy Christian's appeals were rejected. Jeremy's legal team argued that there had been 16 points of error during his trial and sentencing. The appeals court upheld the charges regarding the attack on Demetria. It agreed with the jury that the crimes were committed out of racial bias. The court also agreed with the jury that Jeremy had no remorse for his actions. His team disagreed, pointing out that Jeremy had at one point alluded to remorse when referencing Rick Best, as he hadn't really been involved and he was what he called collateral damage. That sounds nice and all, but there were plenty of statements made by Jeremy that showed he had felt he was allowed to stab all of them and that he did not feel one bit remorseful or sorry about that. The appeals court also agreed that the judge was right to keep the trial in Multnomah County, contrary to Jeremy's complaints that he would not be able to receive a fair trial in the location of the horrendous crime. Though the attack had a lot of media coverage, it was all based in fact, not any of the possible legal defenses Jeremy would have used, so there was no reason to move counties. Another complaint was that Jeremy was one of the first defendants to be given a sentence under the new law, Senate Bill 1013, which called for sentences of 30 years to life without parole for first-degree murder. Since he was a little bit of a guinea pig, his team fought against the sentence. For now, the survivors and family members of victims can rest easy, knowing that Jeremy Christian will, at least for now, continue to fester behind bars. His next step? To take his appeal to the state Supreme Court. While I don't expect his sentence or the outcome to change, it will be interesting and set the standard for the new sentencing law. I'm hopeful it will stand, as this is one of the more sickening and senseless local cases we've covered.
This one really stuck with all of us, I believe.
Yeah.
I think for me, because of the suddenness, a lot of the crimes we talk about, I feel, are not quite so instantaneous.
Yeah, or there's a relationship there. So it's, it was the husband with the estranged wife or the mother-in-law that hated the son-in-law. You know, there's a history there.
And this was just the worst possible confluence of people and location.
Yeah. I'm very relieved that he will be behind bars because, I can picture his face when I think about him. I feel sick to my stomach when I think about that moment on the train and the chaos and, like you said, the instant loss of life, almost like a car accident or something where it's just, boom, you're there 1 second and you're gone the next. So continue to rot in prison, sir.
Alaskan update.
That's right. We've got another Alaska update. In my episode, Fallen Angel, I told the story of 19-year-old Cynthia Hoffman in Alaska. Cynthia, or Cece, as she more often went by, struggled with cognitive disabilities. It hindered her ability to do homework, and she had the mentality of a 12-year-old, but none of that kept her from being a bubbly, happy person. On June 12, 2019, Cece was supposed to pick up some money from one of her sisters. She never arrived. Cece wasn't one to not show up or to ignore the subsequent phone calls. On the morning of the 3rd, there was still no sign of her, so a report was filed with police. Search parties were organized, and they did what they could to help. Timothy, Cece's father, took it upon himself to get the word out about his daughter in any way he could. He did searches of his own, he called local news outlets. He did this because he felt the police were giving him the classic, she's 19, therefore an adult, and she can leave whenever she wants. Just as he was worried about, it would be learned later that the police had not documented his heightened concerns surrounding Cece's cognitive issues. Police apologized later, saying they would have taken the report more seriously if that information had been included in their paperwork like her father had intended. 4 days later, there was a knock on Timothy's door. It was the police. They were there to inform him that Cynthia's body had been found. Even though they hadn't had the correct information about Cece in their documentation, there had been an actual investigation taking place. The night after Cece was seen, detectives arrived at the home of Nicole House and her teenage daughter, Denali Bremmer. Nicole wanted to talk to the police because of what Denali and her friend Anthony had told her the night before. Repeating the story, the teens confessed to shooting Cece in the head and pushing her into a body of water. On the 4th, police spoke with Denali. Once she was read her rights, the 18-year-old told police everything, saying she and her friend Caden McIntosh, a boy also known as Anthony, were with Cece. Attending the same high school, Cece and Denali had become best friends. The day of the 2nd, Cece encountered her friends on her way to get the money from her sister. Getting into her friend's car, they all drove out to an area known as the Valley, where they hung out and smoked some pot before starting the 35-mile drive south to Anchorage. About 10 miles into their journey, the group stopped at Chugiak to view the 200-foot Thunderbird Falls. The trail was an easy one, only a mile long and less than 100-foot gain. Wandering into the woods, the teens decided to play a game. Taking out a Celtic 9mm gun and duct tape, all three agreed to be bound by the tape for a photo shoot. Cece was first. She went along as her ankles and wrists were wrapped. When the tape was placed on her mouth and wrapped around her head, she started to panic. Denali and Caden took the tape off of her head, mouth, and wrists, but that didn't help. Denali claimed Cece started to yell that she was going to call the police and tell them that Denali and Caden had kidnapped and sexually assaulted her. Denali had the gun in her hand, which 16-year-old Caden grabbed away from her, and in a panic to protect himself from trouble, he pointed it at Cece's head and pulled the trigger. With Cece lying on the ground, there was still a concern she could come to and somehow call the police, so he pushed her body into the water. Apparently unfazed by the killing, the pair went back to the car in the parking lot. Getting his alibi in place, Caden told Denali to text one of Cece's sisters, explaining that they had given her a ride but dropped her off. Out of fear for her own life, after seeing what Caden was capable of, Denali went along with him, even joining as they drove away from the Chugiak before stopping at a good place to make a burn pile. In the flames, he threw in some of Cece's clothes, her purse, ID, and even the murder weapon. The next day, they put out a false report of having seen Cece at a park. When Caden was questioned separately from Denali, he concurred. They had all met up, smoked weed in the valley, stopped at the falls, agreed to take the photos, got taped up. But in Caden's case, he didn't have a reason for the shooting. The 16-year-old claimed he just blacked out, but he did remember firing the gun. He also remembered that Cece was still twitching as he pushed her into the water, leaving him wondering aloud if the bullet or the water were her final cause of death. After the murder, they destroyed the evidence. Armed with a confession and location, detectives went to the water, and just like the two teens had claimed, the body of Cynthia Hoffman was found. Her ankles were still bound by the silver tape. After learning of his daughter's death, Timothy wasn't just shocked by her murder, but at who had confessed to being involved. Timothy knew who Denali was, only he knew her as her daughter's friend, Angel. Not only has she been over to the house to hang out with and even have slumber parties with Cece, but since the disappearance, she had been texting Timothy. Some of those messages read, "Is she okay? I hope she comes home safely. She's my best friend. I'm starting to get worried. I love her too. I want the best for her and I want her to come back. She won't answer me. I think she's ignoring everyone. I know she will come home safe." Denali and Caden's confessions and the recovery of Cece led to them being arrested and charged with her murder. After Caden was behind bars, he started telling his story to anyone within earshot, only now it was different from what he had told detectives. Everything was the same, except that shooting Cece was Denali's idea, and she had actually been the one who pulled the trigger. Denali's story changed too. Now she was holding the gun and told Caden to shoot Cece. To support their new tales, there were Snapchat videos. Denali had sent the videos to a friend who turned them over to the police. In the first video, Denali repeats the story she started with. Everyone panicked, she was scared for her life, Caden killed Cece. In the second video, Caden is in the background. Denali is talking to the camera saying, "I just want to thank everyone that's been there for me my whole life and these past few years and everything. I fucked up. I know I did. If I could take back what I've done... I can't. I'm sorry, everybody. My family, my friends. I guess you will hear from me when you hear from me, but I won't be back for a long time. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do it. I didn't mean to do it." Showing Denali the video that appeared to be a confession, she spilled. Taking Cece into the woods had actually been planned. The pair told her they were just going for a hike, but Denali brought the gun as the plan all along was to murder Cece. Once in the moment, Denali freaked out and gave the gun to Caden, asking him to finish the job she couldn't. The following Sunday, a third teenager was arrested, 19-year-old Caleb Leland. Denali and Caden had been friends for about 6 months. The relationship with Caleb was unclear, except that it was a new friendship. Caleb was not part of the shooting, but he had provided Denali and Caden with a vehicle, knowing what their plan was with Cece. That same Sunday, two more teens were arrested, but due to their young age, their names and involvement have not been released. When all was said and done, five teenagers were arrested and charged with first-degree murder and first-degree conspiracy to commit murder. It was becoming clear that all five were involved in a plot to kill Cece. It just wasn't clear why. Enter Darren Schmiller. In Salisbury, Indiana, 21-year-old Darren was living with an older relative in their single-story home on 2 acres in the rural area. Darren had graduated from North Harrison High School in 2017. Classmates recalled memorable aspects about Darren, not that they were positive. He was a shy kid, which led to a lot of bullying. Overall, he was nice, but there was another part to his character that was often recalled. Darren was a creep. As Darren got older, the rumors of his proclivities were a well-known secret in his small farming town. Out of school, he would message friends that now had babies of their own, and he would ask for pictures of the children. He would use fake profiles to try to lure unsuspecting friends. Manipulating emotions, he would message an acquaintance that he desperately needed to tell her a secret. Once engaged in conversation, he would then say that he would not talk until he got pictures of the woman's baby getting a diaper change, including photos of the used diapers.
Whoa. That's pretty gross.
Very gross. This guy is awful. He's one of the worst. In 2018, Darren set his sights outside of Indiana. Contacting women in California, he made his usual request, photos of their infant children and their dirty diapers. Harrison County, where Darren resided, received the complaint and looked into Darren regarding child abuse imagery. Nothing was found, no actions were taken, and the case was closed. That's when Denali, who used her nickname of Angel, came across Darren. But for the 18-year-old in Alaska, Darren in Indiana was actually Tyler in Kansas. The two had met each other online a few months before Cynthia's murder. Tyler shared that he was actually a millionaire. Darren might have been using a different name and face, but his depravity was the same. Somehow, they concocted a plan. Tyler was willing to pay Denali $9 million if she would rape and murder a girl and send him pictures and videos of the attack. In May or June of 2019, Denali agreed to the exchange of money for a life, but decided she would need help. That's when she arranged a meeting with Caden, Caleb, the two other minors, and herself. It was decided that her best friend Cynthia, due to her desperate desire to have friends, combined with her naive innocence and her developmental delay in general, made her the perfect victim. It was decided. Caleb would provide his SUV. Caden and Denali would take her to the park and duct tape her before shooting her. Again, the other two juveniles' involvement is unknown. Before speaking with police, Denali deleted all of her conversations with Tyler. But after confiscating her phone, police were shocked and horrified to find recorded child sex abuse, not even hidden away. The easily accessible images initiated a deeper dive into her phone. There, they found Tyler. Even though the conversations were gone, investigators were able to recover enough to show that the two had been sharing fantasies about raping and murdering a girl. And they had made the deal for the $9 million. Not only had Denali followed up on the murder itself, she kept her part of the deal, sending photos and videos of the murder to Tyler as it was happening. Interviewing the other suspects, they admitted to knowing about Denali's relationship with Tyler and that he had hired her to kill. Assigning the roles they would play, they agreed to a share of the money, Caleb expecting $500,000 for his providing of the car. Detectives found Darren in Indiana. Marshals arrested him and charged him with murder as well. Being interviewed, he shared it all. He and Angel had been talking for about 3 weeks regarding rape and murder before settling on just a murder. He confessed that he knew Cece was Angel's best friend. He told them that he had been sent photos and videos on Snapchat of the attack and of Cece's body. He had, in fact, catfished Denali lying about being rich. He also admitted that, using the photos from the murder, he attempted to blackmail Angel into raping another girl. By then, Darren was arrested, but not for the murder, for the recorded child sex abuse he was in possession of, which had been sent from Denali. By the time all of the pieces were put together, the charges for the six parties involved were staggering. 4 counts of tampering with physical evidence for Caden after he burned Cece's belongings, Denali facing 1 count for the same, Darren and Denali a charge of solicitation to commit murder, Darren for the payout, Denali for the gathering of her friends, 2 counts of murder in the second degree for all 6 defendants, along with conspiracy to commit murder in the first degree and first degree murder and federal recorded child sex abuse charges. That charge alone could earn them each 80 years. The parties were indicted and went to court. In her first appearance, an emotionless Denali confessed to knowing what she had done was wrong. In August 2019, Darren pled not guilty to the recorded child sex abuse and murder charges. And that was where the episode left off. The update is, there was justice served across the board! Denali Dakota Sky Bremmer was sentenced to 99 years for murdering her best friend. Catfish Darren Mitchell Schmiller was also sentenced to 99 years. Caleb Allen Russell Leyland, who would get money for providing a car, pleaded guilty to second-degree murder. He is facing 25 to 75 years. He should have had a sentence hearing in June of this year, but it appears that that did not happen, so we'll have another update later. Caden Brian McIntosh also pled guilty as part of a plea deal. He's looking at 30 to 85 years, and he will be going to court in November. And a bonus for the child sex abuse material Denali produced for and sent to Darren, who was then charged for being in possession of, she received an additional 30 years, and it looks like he may have been given an extra 15. It's all very eerily reminiscent, Josh, of the Rena Virk case and also Under the Bridge, the series we just watched, because it's such a horrific, unimaginable crime, and it's justice in a way of you did wrong and now you're paying for it. But it's really hard to see a group of teenagers.
It never feels like justice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's not to say what they did wasn't.
It's horrific.
Horrific. I know that's kind of cliche and we use that word a lot,
yeah,
but
it's
just
horrifying.
Truly horrifying. Deeply horrifying. Your best friend. And
it was such a large group that kind of started it.
Yes, that she was able to talk 5 other people into it because of money that didn't even exist. Yes, they obviously have issues and some of them might not have any kind of hope there at all. But for other ones, you think, well, geez, if you're 18 and you provided a car to somebody, even if you knew what it was, is that justice to say that life is gone now? I will keep everyone posted on those other sentences, but at the very least, I'm glad Darren, because for me, Darren and Angel are the two that got the 99 years, and those are the two that earned those 99 years. So it is nice that the heads of the beast, if you will, got the most time.
Got to put those heads in jail.
Yeah.
Cut them off. Ugh. Hope no new ones sprout up.
Everything he was doing. He's the grossest to me. Most unforgivable. So, bye. Have fun in jail for 99 years. Prison. Bad prison. Big, bad Alaska prison.
Hopefully it's unnatural. The cause of what happens to you.
This next case started as a Patreon, but we used it on the main feed a while back. It was titled HOMICIDE and surrounded the death of Dennis Day, a former Mouseketeer. Back in the 1950s, there were local branches of the Mickey Mouse Club. They were hugely popular, so Disney decided to make an official club with a TV show. For 1 hour every weekday, the Young Mouseketeers would perform musical numbers, skits, and have special guests and more. Annette Funicello and Bobby Burgess were two of the more popular Mouseketeers. Another cast member was the adorable, big-smiled 12-year-old Dennis Day. Dennis had started his acting career when he was 6 and scored big when he landed the gig as a Mouseketeer. He was part of the cast for 2 seasons. Dennis's tap dancing, banjo playing, show business savvy, and persistence mattered more in the club than his notorious tone deafness. After two seasons with Mickey, Dennis continued to work in show business and was drawn to the counterculture of the 60s and 70s. He worked at a theater in New York, taught drama and dancing in L.A., directed musicals, was a producer, and wrote a dance manual. For nearly 20 years, Dennis was the musical director for the California Renaissance Fairs and Dickens Christmas Fair. As only a handful of known celebrities that were out at the time, Dennis seemed to effortlessly live the life he wanted without fear of repercussions. It was at one of the festivals Dennis was working when he met the nearly 12 years older Henry Ernie Caswell. He had just as interesting a resume as Dennis. He was a performer and manager, was a priest with the Christ Catholic Church, and spoke five languages. The two fell in love and eventually moved to Southern Oregon, building their lives in Phoenix, Oregon, which is about halfway between Ashland and Medford. They were officially married in 2013. As time went on, things became harder. Ernie had mental and physical ailments that come with age. Their house was becoming dilapidated. Ernie would eventually be moved into an assisted living facility. 2 days after Ernie's admittance to the facility on July 15, 2018, Dennis went to visit his friend Kirk Peterson. Kirk had introduced Dennis and Ernie to his handyman, Daniel Bruda. It was clear the guys needed help with their house, so Kirk paid Daniel $100 to spend a day working on it. Before Ernie left the home, Daniel was living with them in exchange for handyman work.
Well, you know, beware the handyman.
Yeah. Which is unfair to all the handymen and custodians and people that help make the world actually run.
People with that sort of talent in their hands, yes. But also,
there's something about the accessibility and the...
That's not a job you have to apply for generally.
It's one that's like, oh yeah, I don't care if you've got a arrest record and now here are all the keys. And you're kind of, as someone who does professional cleaning, part of your job is to be invisible.
It's a skill that someone would develop over time, becoming part of the wall, sort of.
Yeah, I think so.
Invisible in plain sight, yeah.
Yeah. Soon there were tensions between the three, and that was why Dennis was going to Kirk's house. Daniel had become physically violent, and Dennis wanted him gone. Because the small-town police station was closed that Sunday night, Kirk promised to take Dennis in the morning to file a report. Dennis did not return to Kirk's in the morning, and he had not been to see Ernie, who was getting worried. Ernie had staff call the police to conduct a welfare check. When they did, Daniel answered and had said Dennis, quote, went out of town to go visit people, but he wasn't sure who or where or for how long. 12 days after Dennis went to Kirk's house and 10 days since the first welfare check, police returned to the home. Again, there was no sign of Dennis. Now there was real concern. Dennis may have been the type to leave town for a few days, but he was not one to abandon his husband or their house. That was when an APB was put out for Dennis's car. The day before the APB went out and 130 miles away in Coos County, Dennis's 1996 Ford Escort was found in the possession of a woman from Medford, Lori DeClusen. She claimed to be borrowing the car from her friend, Dennis, but police soon learned that her actual friend in the scenario was Daniel. This took Dennis's disappearance from suspicious to frightening. Police informed Ernie that Dennis's car had been recovered, so they officially listed Dennis Day as missing. Sadly, because of Ernie's memory issues, he was unable to provide basic information about his husband, their friends, or their family. All that was known was Daniel felt Dennis had left town to visit family, but Dennis's close friends found it hard to believe that Dennis, who had become nearly a hermit, hardly ever leaving his home, would be gone for more than a day or two, if at all. The detectives involved continued to examine the recovered vehicle and Dennis's home. There were no clues, no signs of foul play. Searching the house, the police were up against a challenge, investigating a small home that was crowded and not being cared for. While they didn't say specifically, it has been implied that Dennis and Ernie were hoarders or, as my training taught me, acquirers, to a certain degree. This could have led to the house not being the easiest to search, although they did so at least 3 times, hoping to find any sign as to where Dennis would have gone. During those searches, police went through the couple's drawers, cabinets, and even the crawl space. Weeks of searching turned into months. Soon, word spread to those who had worked with Dennis through the years, and a Facebook group was started. A beloved friend, performer, husband, and mouseketeer had vanished, and his friends were desperate to do anything they could to help. From as early as 3 weeks into the investigation, there had been reports from neighbors and calls to 911 that were made regarding a foul odor coming from the house. One of the calls came from the Meals on Wheels volunteer delivery driver. Officers didn't go to the house after each call. They did go to the house for investigative searches, during which there was no overwhelmingly concerning smell, although there were reports of urine and excrement being throughout the house, which could have led to a dismissal of all other odors. Finally, in April 2019, 10 months after Dennis had last been seen, officers took a canine unit to the house to search for clues. After three unsuccessful previous searches, they finally got a hit on something, and it was much more than a clue. The dog had signaled at something under a pile of clothing. Sadly, what the dog had discovered was Dennis's decomposing body, a body that, according to a Day family lawyer, had been stepped on and walked across while concealed beneath clothing multiple times by police officers during those searches. They had stepped on Dennis's remains so much they had actually caused skeletal fractures. It took a month for the remains to be confirmed as Dennis, as DNA and dental records could not be used due to the body's condition. It was learned Dennis had called the police before his disappearance back in July of 2018, and he reported to police that his live-in handyman, Daniel Bruda, had, quote, behaved violently towards him. The responding officer's solution? That he, Dennis, would need to start the formal eviction process against Daniel. At the start of the searches and investigation when Dennis was still missing, the police spoke with Daniel at the house on two different occasions. On body cam footage, there are obvious injuries and wounds to his hands and arms that were consistent with an altercation. Daniel was arrested and charged with manslaughter, abuse of a corpse, and identity theft. It was then the 36-year-old's extensive legal history came to light. He had a decade-long arrest and prison record, including serving time for sodomy, robbery, and assault. He also started using meth a year before Dennis's death. Questioned, Daniel claimed that while he had only been living with Dennis and Ernie for a couple of months, Dennis wanted him out of the house. They had frequent arguments about it, and tensions were high. Once Ernie went into assisted living, things only got worse. Then, 2 weeks after Ernie left, things became really heated. Dennis and Daniel's arguments became physical when Daniel pushed Dennis to the ground. It's unclear if he died from the fall or was injured, but to literally cover up his crime, Daniel hid Dennis's body, perhaps while he was still alive, under a pile of clothes in the living room. There are a few other reasons the cause of death is not actually known. Daniel admitted that as the smell of death started to take over the home, he used different chemicals to help. Those chemicals destroyed evidence. Additionally, after having the police step on the pile of clothes and damage Dennis's skeleton, the medical examiner was unable to say which injuries were from Daniel and what came from the weight of being stepped on. After the arrest, Daniel Bruda was found unfit to stand trial due to a mental health condition that remains in his sealed documents. It was clear to the doctors who worked with him that Daniel was unaware of how serious his actions were or how serious the charges were. This was at the end of 2019. One of the women found using Dennis's car and being in possession of stolen items from the home was Lori Ann DeClusen. She lived in the Day home with Daniel Bruda. Lori is 39 years old and from Anchorage, Alaska. She pleaded not guilty to charges of unauthorized use of a motor vehicle and first-degree theft. Wanda Diane Garcia, another woman who had been in Dennis's car, pled guilty to vehicle theft and was sentenced to a year and a half on probation. Lori skipped court, so a warrant was put out for her arrest. She was caught and arrested at some point because she, quote, walked away from a correctional facility and stole another car. She was arrested in a Buffalo Wild Wings parking lot. Lori and another man, who I believe is her husband, Curtis DeClusen, were both called to be witnesses for the state of Oregon against Daniel, especially since Lori had spent time in Dennis's home where Daniel told her to stay out of a specific room and she reported smelling a pungent and off-putting smell. Daniel was eventually found fit for trial. At his first hearing for the 12 charges against him, he pleaded not guilty. In July of this year, Daniel entered a modified guilty plea of no contest regarding the charges of criminally negligent homicide and abuse of a corpse. While he was out of custody, he was found guilty of burglary, earning a 2-year sentence. For the negligent homicide of Dennis Day and abuse of a corpse, Daniel Bruda was sentenced to...
time served.
Very close. 4 years.
And he did a murder?
I hope everyone's sitting down, if you can handle this. mind-blowing information. Because the cops in this small town fumbled this investigation so badly and they could not prove how he died because they stepped on his body and broke it, and they didn't find him any earlier when there was still DNA and other evidence like wounds or things of that nature, they can't prove anything other than what Daniel said, which is, we got in an argument and I pushed him and he fell down. And then he just stayed there. So the fact that he even admitted that part, if he hadn't admitted that, his defense probably could have come in and said, oh, he fell down and this guy isn't mentally fit, so he just put clothes over it because he was scared. And he probably wouldn't have had anything. So at least he admitted to pushing him. So because of the police's inability to find Dennis's body for so long, and because of the damage they caused to his corpse, his family is suing the Phoenix, Oregon Police Department for $2 million. Fun fact, you know all of those complaints of smells that the neighbors called in about? The police department was only 2 blocks from Dennis's home, so they probably smelled it too. The trial for the lawsuit is set to take place this October, and I hope the family gets every dime, and I hope all the residents of Phoenix are very upset as usual that their taxpayer money that should go to education and other positive things is being used to cover up police mess ups.
You did say taxpayers, but it is all a game, baby.
That's right. We are all tax players in this game of life. So when that trial happens in October, I will let you guys know what the family ends up getting from the police in Phoenix.
Life is a lot more like the game of life than I thought it would be. It's very mundane, generally, and hard to get through. By Parker Brothers.
Yeah.
By Milton Bradley.
By somebody.
By somebody. Just like we scripted it. Is that it? Very quick and only took
first defendants to be given a sentence under the new state law. What are you saying, ding dong?
I really downed that hummus.
God damn it.
The photos has comes from foul or I can never say that one. And was sentenced to 1.5 years on probation. Lori skipped court, so a warrant was put out for her arrest. She was caught at some point because she walked away. Oh my gosh, why am I saying things so weird?
Walked away. Let's keep it on the down low.
You're keeping it on the down low?
I don't know what. I don't even know what that means.
Well, Oprah taught me it meant men that were married to women but hooking up with men.
Oh, that's not me.
Keeping it on the down.
I'm not married.
Murder in the Rain is a Cascade Media production, written, hosted, and edited by Josh McCullough, Emily Rowney, and Alicia Holland. Feel free to email us at murderintherain@gmail.com or through our website, murderintherain.com. For as little as $1 a month, you can subscribe on Patreon to get exclusive access to ad-free and older episodes. For only $5, you can access Patreon-exclusive episodes and content. For more of us, be sure to follow on all the socials, listen to Josh and Alicia on their other show, Always Be My Sisters, and follow Emily on TikTok at @M_murderinTheRain. And suck my balls.